So I've been thinking of representations lately, and that they may play a larger role, that they have more applicability than one might naively think. And I'd be glad for your feedback. So here's the talk. What do we mean by representations traditionally? Traditionally, the term representation theory means something quite specific, namely that we have a map phi from some algebraic structure, which is typically a Lie group or a Lie algebra, into the set or a set of matrices in such a way that you are what is called representing that algebraic structure as matrices, which means in practice that it doesn't matter whether you do first the operations in the algebraic structure, such as in a Lie group, you multiply first A and B, two Lie group elements, and then map them into a matrix. That should be the same as if you take the two Lie group elements, A and B, map them into matrices separately, and then multiply those matrices, right? In other words, phi is a map that respects the operations of the algebraic structure. And you know, of course, that this is a very powerful and often used theory, this representation theory, for the representations of Lie groups and Lie algebras as they are used, for example, in the Standard Model. But the general idea is actually much more widely applicable. It doesn't have to be that the algebraic structures are algebras or Lie algebras or groups, and that the representation maps into matrices. It could be far more general than that. The underlying principle here of a representation is simply that it's a map from some structure into another structure that is conserving or respecting the operations in those structures. So in general, representations can be viewed as any structure-preserving map, phi from some structure A into some structure B. For example, let's say A is the abstract axioms of a vector space. That's some structure. And then any concrete vector space is a representation of that, because we can map into concrete vectors, and it will respect the addition and multiplication with scalars and so on. And then, of course, in quantum mechanics, we know that the abstract states psi and operators f hat, this could be position, momentum, energy, or whatever, that these abstract states and operator on a Hilbert space possess what we call, rightly, representations, position representations, momentum representations, and so on. In this case, all of those representations happen to be unitarily equivalent because of the Stone-Von-Neumann theorem. But in other circumstances, representations can be inequivalent, as we know, for example, from the representations of Lie groups. For another example that's a little bit more pure mathy, every cohomology theory, such as the Rahm cohomology, is really just a representation of the category or set of differentiable manifolds into the category of abelian groups. So it's a very general principle that you have some structure and you map them somewhere else, where you have then a concrete realization of it in such a way that the operations are being respected. And then we also have approximate representations. For example, classical phase space functions over the XP plane. Classical phase space is an approximate representation of an underlying more abstract structure, which is the quantum Poisson algebra of quantum mechanics. The Poisson algebra of quantum mechanics is, well, you know, it's the Poisson algebra. It has the Lie bracket, which is the Poisson bracket. It has also an associative multiplication. And in quantum mechanics, it's non-commutative. That's an abstract algebraic structure. It's a non-commutative, associative, and Lie algebra, the Poisson algebra of quantum mechanics. And we know that it has an approximate representation on classical phase space, because that's what physics started out with. We used to work with these classical phase spaces, and they worked fairly well until classical mechanics ran into a crisis and quantum mechanics had to be discovered. But the Poisson algebra of quantum mechanics has, at least in the classical regime, it has an approximate representation on classical phase space. So what we see here is that the classical phase space representation of the quantum mechanical Poisson algebra is approximately right, but truly there is something more fundamental, namely quantum mechanics underlying it. And we know that fundamentally there is no such thing as a classical phase space because we can't localize in position momentum simultaneously, so there is no such thing as points in phase space. And therefore, in principle, it's all wrong, the classical phase space. But it's still a damn good approximation when it comes to rocket science or regular mechanical engineering. Other approximate representations. For example, experimental quantum circuits are at best approximate representations of what is truly underlying, which is a quantum algorithm that we want to implement. Another example of an approximate representation is this. Imagine that space-time actually has torsion. There's no evidence that it has torsion, but if for the moment we assume it has some torsion, just too small that we haven't yet measured it. So if space-time has torsion, then our current descriptions of space-time as a Lorentzian manifold without torsion is at best approximate. It's not fully correct. It's a representation, but not strictly. It misses something. Of course, if we zoomed in this circumstance into a physical scenario where the torsion becomes important, we would notice that the representation is only approximate. Similar to quantum mechanics, we might get away with the classical phase-based description a lot of times, but there are, of course, regimes where it shows that the representation is a bad one. And I'd like you to keep that in mind, that approximate representations can be pretty good in some regimes, but then you go to some other regime where it really shows that it's only approximate and not a true representation. And now let's jump. This was just a general introduction, and you might think, yeah, okay. But here's the question I want to address today. Quantum field theory on curved space-time is as far as we know physics, right? We know general relativity, we know quantum field theory, and we can put them together, not in the form of quantum gravity yet, but at least in the form of having quantum fields on curved space-time. And the success of inflationary cosmology indicates that we are not really wrong with this. This seems to work. So quantum field theory on curved space-time summarizes, it's the sum total of what we know so far. And let's ask whether this theory, quantum field theory on curved space-time, is that perhaps a representation? Is that perhaps, can we view that as an approximate representation, perhaps, of some more underlying, more abstract structure? So that in the usual regimes that we probe with our accelerators and cosmology and so on, yes, we find that quantum field theory in curved space-time is a good representation, but there will be regimes, such as the Planck regime, where it shows that it's not a good representation of what is truly the underlying abstract structure. So what if there really is an underlying more abstract structure of which we can show that quantum field theory and curved space-time is an approximate representation? Well, if we found out what that underlying abstract structure is, then we could check, does it have other representations too? Could it be, for example, that quantum reference frames are also representations of this underlying abstract structure? Could it be that dualities, like ADS-CFT, are also just different ways of representing the same underlying abstract structure? And if quantum field theory on curved space-time is really just a approximate representation of some more fundamental underlying structure, then what about those regimes where it's not even a good approximation, where it's just completely off? If we knew what the underlying abstract structure is, we could explore those regimes where this approximation is not so great, and that might help us in the direction of quantum gravity. So let's search for this. Let's look at quantum field theory in curved space-time from a fresh angle and see, could it be that this is a representation, maybe an approximate representation, of a more abstract underlying structure? And we will do that on the basis of two observations. Here's the first observation, which is looking fairly trivial. The first observation is that matter is describable through correlators. Correlators meaning correlation functions. That's obvious, because if we open any textbook on particle physics, we find that the behavior of matter, all kinds of matter, can always be described in terms of quantum field theoretical endpoint functions. What are these endpoint functions? They are the Taylor coefficients of the partition function, right? The Taylor coefficients of the path integral. But we also can directly interpret them as correlators. So they correlate the quantum fluctuations at various points in space-time. So having observed that matter can be described entirely, I mean matter and its behavior can be described entirely in terms of correlation functions, we could now say, well, look, this means everything that matter does and is describable in terms of correlations, and that means information theoretically, because that's what information theory is all about correlators. So we could go in this direction now, and we'll later come back to this. We could, for example, and that's something that in my group we're interested in, we could, for example, ask, can we describe the standard model of particle physics in terms of information theory? Instead of writing an interaction Hamiltonian as so-and-so and such, and these indices contract, maybe we should describe interaction Hamiltonians through their ability to transmit classical and quantum information. It could be an equivalent description. Because what happens when particles interact with each other? They exchange classical and quantum information. They hand over entanglement. Let's say a particle is previously entangled with an ancilla particle, and now this particle interacts with another one. Well, then it may hand over some of that entanglement with the ancilla to the particle that it just interacted with. That's the essence of quantum channel capacity, that pre-existing entanglement is being handed over. So since all of what matter does can be described in terms of correlators, and correlators are what information theory describes, I think there's a fair chance we can re-describe everything that happens in quantum field theory as the transmission and processing of information. It's not clear at this point why that would be better, but it's another way of looking at things. I will later come back to why that might be better. But now let's move on to the second observation. So after having observed that matter is describable entirely in terms of correlators, the second observation is that space-time itself is also entirely describable through correlators. And by that I mean the space-time metric. The curvature, the affine connection, is entirely describable through correlators. And that's work that goes back to lectures I gave in this room some years ago on quantum field theory in curved space-time. And two of the students there, Mehdi Saravani and Siavash Aslan Beygi, had some interest in what I had to say, and we worked out a question that I had asked, and that's the result of this work. So what we showed is that if you know what the two-point correlators is of a quantum field theory, in this case of a scalar one, but you can do that also for vector and spinor fields, So if G superscript 2 is the two-point correlator of a scalar quantum field theory, where the I-epsilon prescription doesn't matter, it could be advanced, retarded, Feynman propagators, doesn't matter, then by differentiating with respect to both arguments, taking a coincidence limit, and you have to take it to a certain power, 2 divided by 2 minus d, where capital D is the number of space-time dimensions, then take the coincidence limit and some normalization factor in front, you actually get the metric. Which means that if you want to map out the curvature of space-time, the metric of space-time, you don't need a meter, and you don't need clocks. All you need to do is count quantum fluctuations. If you go to various places and you measure the quantum fluctuations and you calculate from your measurements of just quantum fluctuations what the correlator is, then having the correlator, you can work out what the metric is. Right? So it's an alternative way to mapping out what the shape of the space-time manifold is, expressing the metric entirely in terms of the two-point correlator. You might wonder,
this is where you have a sort of a fixed non-dynamical curved space-time?
Well, it doesn't have to be constant in time. And it could be the solution of whichever Einstein equation. This is not a...
That solution is not coupled to the
quantum field, as such. Oh, yeah, no. The field has to be a solution to its wave equation for that curved background.
Okay.
So the reason is that the reason why the two-point function knows what the metric is that the wave equation is modified on the curved background. That's how it can know that. Another perspective of it is it's like spectral geometry, where you're trying to hear in the sound of a vibrating object what its shape is. And here we are listening to the quantum fluctuations of the field. And then we can actually reconstruct the metric of it. I can also demystify this equation in another way. Imagine I know that two-point correlator. Well, what is it a function of? The two-point correlator of a scalar field is a function of the invariant distance, of the geodesic distance between x and y. But if you know geodesic distances, and if you even just know it at arbitrarily close separation, if you know geodesic distances, then you know the metric. You see, the strength of the correlation of quantum fluctuations here and there depends on how far the two events are away from another. When the two events are very close, the quantum fluctuations are strongly correlated. And the further away the two events are, the more weakly are the quantum fluctuations correlated. In other words, the strength of the correlations, the size of the magnitude of G, tells you how far away the two events are. That's why you can get the metric from that. And the interesting thing is that in a subtle way, this depends on the correlations depend on the curvature of space-time. And therefore, you can actually get the metric in this way, which means that you can describe a curved space-time either the traditional way, like as a differentiable manifold M with a metric tensor on it, or as a differentiable manifold with a fine connection on it, for example. But you can also describe it as a differentiable manifold with a propagator on it, with a two-point function on it that describes the same thing. So what we saw is, in observations 1 and 2, that matter and space-time are completely encoded just knowing what the endpoint functions are. So the summary so far is that both matter and space-time are completely expressible through the quantum field theoretical endpoint functions. So the n we should think of as running from 1 to infinity. Yeah?
On the previous slide, you had just G2.
Yeah.
So you express space time. But the next slide, you said you need the Gn.
Yes, that's because of observation 1. You see, the matter is describable through these correlators. And for example, if you have two particles scattering and two particles come out, that's already a four-point function. And if you have like 370 particles crashing into each other and 5,000 coming out, you have a correspondingly high function there. And so in principle, you need all of those.
Professor, could I ask a couple questions? So is it helpful to think of the correlator as power law or the two-point correlator? Can I think of it as a power law?
As the power of the two-point correlators? That would be the case for a free theory. For a free theory, a theory without interactions, the endpoint functions are all products of two-point functions. But if there are interactions in the theory, then they are not. Then it's non-trivial. You have to sum up. You have to integrate the Feynman graphs and then sum them up and all that.
I had a second question. Does that formula make sense for D equals 2?
The previous one, no, but we also have it for d equal 2, but then it's a special form. It has a logarithm in it. Because as always, you know, 2d is always special because of its conformal symmetry and so on. Okay. Now, that's fine. It means that we can describe space-time and matter in terms of these endpoint functions, but there's still something that we would like to get rid of, which is the coordinate dependence here. You see those gn are different functions and different coordinates. And remember the situation in quantum mechanics. We could work with the Schrödinger equation in the position representation, always. We could just consistently describe all the wave functions in the position representation and everything in position representation, the Green's function in the position representation. But we know that it's useful to not think of it this way, but instead say that actually, when we write down a position wave function psi of x, then this is really just that. And this is the object of interest and the state itself. And we just have position eigenvectors here to get to a position wave function. But the state itself is an abstract vector. And similarly here, we have these endpoint functions that are written in a positional representation, but there's a lot of arbitrariness in this. We could choose different coordinate systems, and the functional behavior would be different. So let's see, can we find a more abstract coordinate-free formulation of that?
Coming from general relativity as well, where coordinates are problematic.
Yes, exactly. Yes, that's right, especially because this is happening on a curved space-time background, and therefore, we would like not to have that dependence here. So as I mentioned, in quantum mechanics, for example, the Green's function g of x, x prime can always be written in any basis we want, position representation, momentum representation, or any other representation. But we know that such a Green's function or integral kernel in general is always some abstract Hilbert space operator. And then we just apply a basis, a choice of basis, in order to turn it into explicit functions. But here, too, we can do that. We can take the correlators, gn of x1 to xn, and recognize that they represent abstract Hilbert space operators in a choice of basis. In mathematically the same way, this is not a physics statement, it's just a mathematical statement, that these functions of multiple variables are integral operators on fields of these variables. And as such, they're just mapping vectors in a Hilbert space into vectors in a Hilbert space. And while a two-point correlator is a matrix or an operator which has two indices, these correlators would be matrices which have n indices. And therefore, they are n-argument Hilbert space operators. We don't usually work with those. The Hilbert space operators that we work with usually just have two indices so that they map vector into vector. But these guys have n indices, so they can actually act on multiple vectors of that Hilbert space at once. But it's really not more complicated than a matrix with n indices. And of course, that is, again, an abstract map of vector spaces into vector spaces, and as such can be written in a basis-independent form. OK, so if we do that, if we drop the coordinate dependence and just look at these correlators as abstract operators that are n-argument Hilbert space operators, then in principle, we have here a set of operators, these gn, of which we know that they describe the matter and the space-time content of the theory. So it looks as if we might be lucky and the set of these gn's viewed as operators in the same way that we go from the psi of x to the psi, as abstract operators, could give us a coordinate-free description of quantum field theory in curved space-time. Or does it? You see, if that's really true, then we should be able to start with these guys and then recover these. So let's see. Is the set of the GN an equivalent description of space-time and matter? Well, given the operators GN, how can we represent them again as field correlators on a space-time manifold? And this is the first time where we see how this representation that I was talking about from the very beginning comes in. These guys are abstract. And then they have a representation in terms of those guys. So these are abstract operators on a Hilbert space, and we ask, can we reconstruct how they are represented as endpoint correlators of fields that live on a curved space-time? Because remember, these are just a bunch of operators on a Hilbert space. That's all they are. But then we want to see if they can be represented as endpoint correlation functions of quantum fields on a curved space-time. You see how fields and space-time arise only in the representation. The abstract thing knows nothing about it. It's just a bunch of operators that act on a Hilbert space. These guys are correlators of fields that live on a curved space-time. So how can we do that? Imagine you were just given the abstract operators there. That's all they are. It's the G superscript n is an operator that acts on n Hilbert space vectors, any one of these Hilbert space vectors. How can we get back to an explicit representation like that? If we could do this, if we could go from here to a positional representation, then we're all set. Because remember, that includes the G superscript 2. And from the G superscript 2, we can calculate the metric too. So we would have the correlators for the matter, and we would have the underlying metric of the space-time as well. Now, if this was quantum mechanics, we would have an easy strategy. If you're given the psi, you get the psi of x very easily, just taking the eigenvectors of the position operator. But in quantum field theory, we don't have position operators to do this. So in quantum mechanics, we would use position operators to obtain positional bases. But here in quantum field theory, we don't have position operators. But what we can do is we can use the locality of interactions to rediscover what the positional representations are, to find the position bases, to find the analog of those guys, but for the quantum field theory. So nature does us a favor here in that the interactions are local. So if the theory's interactions are local, then the vertices, that is to say the G superscript n operators, for n larger than 2, so they describe really vertices, then they are diagonalizable, because that's what it means that the theory is local. It means that these endpoint functions in a suitable basis of the Hilbert space are diagonal, meaning that non-zero only if all points agree. Diagonal in the multi-index sense. And a diagonalizing basis is a coordinate system. You see, the very locality of the interaction allows us to find out in which basis these abstract operators are diagonal. You see, it was so much easier to go from these to the abstract ones. But here, what we're doing is we start from the abstract ones and we recover the coordinate representation of them. And once we have those guys, by diagonalizing the vertices, I mean, we just keep track of which basis is diagonalizing the Gn. In these bases, we can then write down all of these Gns, including the G2. But once we have the G2, the propagator, we can calculate what the metric is. And those correlation functions tell us how the matter is moving on that metric. So by the way, what this is telling us is that spectral geometry can be fixed. Remember that we cannot hear the shape of a drum. There are circumstances, there are regimes in which you can hear the shape of a drum. There are certain manifolds which have the property that their metric can be reconstructed from knowing only the spectrum of the Laplace operator, that is to say the wave operator, therefore the acoustic spectrum that you would hear of that manifold. But in general, you can't. And there are reasons for that. And if you like, I can show you some papers that others and I wrote on this. But here,
is there a constraint if you have G of N for two different G events, and they both have, say, X1 in it, then do you have to get the same basis for both of those cases?
Yes, the same.
There's a constraint on this big collection of operators.
Yes, that's right.
Have to be diagonalized in the same.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And it's interesting that you mention that, because you see, later on we will see that if you start with generic GNs, then there is no reason in principle that, for example, the G3 would be a diagonal on the same basis as the G4 is, or the G5. If we start with the quantum field theory in curved space-time, and then we lift it to this basis-independent representation, then it's guaranteed to be the case, because we start with a local theory. But if we start with these guys, well, they describe much more. That's the whole point, right? That if we start with quantum field theory in curved space-time, we can lift it to this abstract description. But not all of these abstract structures can be represented in terms of quantum fields that live on a curved space-time.
Generically, they can't.
Generically, they can't, absolutely. By far, most can't. All right, so my point here is that spectral geometry, just a sec, please. Spectral geometry asks, can we calculate the shape of a manifold from the spectrum of the two-point function? Two-point function is equivalent to knowing the Laplacian, because they're inverses to each other. The spectrum of one is the inverse of the spectrum of the other. And the answer is no. But here we see that if you also have access to three-point functions or four-point functions, then you can do it. Because if you have access to those, you can diagonalize them, you get a position representation, and then, bang, you can calculate the metric, you get the shape. Right? But how do you get access to three-point and four-point higher-point functions? You do it by drumming the drum really hard. Because if you drum it really hard, you get into the nonlinear regime of it. You see, any oscillator is harmonic close to the equilibrium. But virtually every real harmonic oscillator becomes anharmonic if you excite it hard enough. So in principle, if you just drum your drum hard enough, then it doesn't sound harmonic anymore. You may have heard that there are certain drums in certain cultures, if you drum them really hard, they are no longer harmonic. But it's great because it tells you from the sound alone what the shape of it is. You had a question?
Sorry, can you explain again why, if the theory's interactions are local, then this Gn are diagonalizable?
Well, because the vertex of, let's say, a phi to the third theory, the vertex is actually a Dirac delta of x1 minus x2 times a Dirac delta of x1 minus x3. Right? And that means it's diagonal. The three-point vertex is only non-zero when all of the coordinates are at the same point. And that's a diagonal, that's a generalization of the notion of diagonal. Diagonal is clear for matrices with two indices, but you can generalize that notion to matrices with three indices. It just means that all the indices have the same to be the same for the entry to be non-zero. Okay, so then, and you've already anticipated this, the question is, do all of these GNs describe a space, time, and matter? No, by far most don't. And that's because for generic GN, for n larger 2, they are generally not even individually diagonalizable. much less if they are diagonalizable. The G3 might be diagonalizable in a different basis than the G4. But even individually, they may not even be diagonalizable at all. There is no spectral theorem that would guarantee that they are diagonalizable.
Professor, mm-hmm. Is that essentially the same as saying the transformation isn't unitary in general?
Which transformation?
So non-diagonalizability in this abstract GN sense. And so far, if it's diagonalizable, then...
Yes, if it's diagonalizable, then there exists a change of bases in the Hilbert space of fields,
right?
And change of bases is always unitary. So when I say it's not diagonalizable, it means there is no unitary that would do it. Yes?
So if you had a different interaction which gave you a different set, you would not expect them to be diagonalizable.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's where unitary...
Yes, and you see, and I think this... Yes, and I think that, you know, nature is trying to tell us here something, right? In that we always get the same locality for whatever fields we use. It's non-trivial, actually. I don't know what nature is telling us here, but it is telling us something. That the QCD interaction Hamiltonian, the QED interaction Hamiltonian, they're all diagonal in the same basis. Even though they are different interactions, mathematically, there would not be any reason for that to be the case. Okay, so, however, what might happen is that for some generic GN, what might happen is that in some regime, there might be an approximate diagonalizability. So if we have that these guys are diagonalizable approximately, well, then we can approximately use all those formulas before, and we get a metric, which is approximately right, etc. But in other regimes that we might call high-energy regimes, we see that actually these approximations are not good approximations. It's different, really. So what that means is that generic GN may, at most, have a regime in which they can be approximately represented as the correlation functions of quantum fields that live on a curved space-time, but in general, they just can't.
So you've got some theorem that said there's a reason why this world we live in is
absolutely
like some kind of relaxation theorem or something like this.
Yes. I wish I had one. Yes. That's right. Okay. Right. And here's a reference for this, what I just said. Here's a summary so far. So space-time and matter are describable by a collection of abstract endpoint correlators, GN, and a priori, the set of space-time representation could include, for example, quantum reference frames. It could be that we represent on one coordinate system, another coordinate system, but these abstract GNs might as well have representations that we at first don't recognize as the usual ones, and maybe they are a quantum reference frame. Representations. I don't know, but I would be super keen on finding out whether that's the case. Or even other supposedly equivalent representations of the same theory in very different settings, such as an ADS-CFT or related duality, they might perhaps be viewable as different representations of the same underlying structure. Okay, so why that is so, if we start with a quantum field theory on a curved space-time, then we have all of this. But if the GN are generic, then they are at best approximately representable as quantum field theoretical correlators on a space-time manifold, and in general, they just don't possess such a representation. Which means we can still work with them. We can still do all sorts of calculations. They just can't be represented as the correlation functions of quantum fields on a curved space-time. They might have a representation in terms of completely something different, right? So it's the same abstract structure of GNs, which in some regime that we might call a low-energy regime, can be approximately represented in terms of the correlators of quantum fields on a curved space-time. But in another regime, they might have a completely different representation where it's not to do with matter, not to do with space-time, but maybe something completely different. So in this way, quantum field theory in curved space-time could be an approximate representation of some more fundamental abstract endpoint correlators of some theory, which is the theory of the GNs, which is fundamentally pre-geometric. It doesn't guarantee or assume that there is a geometry. It doesn't assume that we are dealing with fields living on a space-time. Okay, so a theory of the GN. Now, first of all, why would it be that the GN, the collection of all those GNs, represents a theory? Well, actually, it's, in hindsight, it's quite plausible, because let's remember that the set of all GN in ordinary quantum field theory, the set of all the GN is equivalent to an action. I don't remember meeting anybody who knew that, but it should be really known that when you solve a quantum theory, you do a Fourier transform. When you solve a classical theory, you do a Legendre transform. Now, let me show you how that works for the quantum field theory. Some of you may know that, of course. Here is e to the power I times the action. That's the function that we are going to Fourier transform. That's what the path integral is, right? Because e to the power I times j phi, that's a Fourier factor. And we're integrating over the phi. So the path integral is a Fourier transform. Technically, it's, of course, uncountably many Fourier transform, ordinary Fourier transform. It's a functional Fourier transform. So the partition function is really just the uncountably many Fourier transforms, or one functional Fourier transform of e to the power I times the action. And the partition function is having as its Taylor coefficients these. Right? So if you know all of those, you have the partition function. And you can do an inverse Fourier transform, which gives you e to the power I times the action. Just remember that the path integral has an inverse, because it's a Fourier transform. OK, so to look for a theory of the GN is actually the same as looking for a theory for the action. They just differ by a functional Fourier transform. We either deal with the partition function, or we deal with the action. They're related by the path integral, which is a Fourier transform. If you do the stationary phase approximation of that Fourier integral, you get the Legendre transform, and you get classical mechanics. OK, so looking for the theory of the GN, the abstract theory of the GN, can be mapped into looking for an abstract theory of the S of phi, which would get us back into familiar territory. We look at the action of the standard model, and we wonder, where does it come from? But there's another way of looking at it. We could view this as the primary thing instead of that. I mean, we've tried this, and it's hard. So maybe we could look at those as the primary ones, these GNs here, and recognize that those guys are correlators, and therefore the natural building blocks of information theory. You see, a one-point correlator is just a probability distribution. And that, in information theory, gives us von Neumann entropies and Rényi entropies. The two-point correlators in information theory, those give us mutual information, coherent information, classical and quantum channel capacities, negativity of entanglement, and so on. And then the higher order correlators give us generalized concepts of information theory, higher order entanglement, for example, just a higher order web of informational relationships, a zoo that we haven't quite completely classified yet.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Can you
repeat
this part? Why N1 is von Neumann?
N1 is just a probability distribution, right? So you have just a G of X, just a probability distribution. And then if you have N equal 2, so the G has two arguments, then you get a correlator. Right?
Okay.
So, and then if it has three arguments, then you get the three-point correlator. And that, for example, describes three-point entanglement.
Are there because they are functional, just one argument in between information?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Right, so one way to study the theory of the GN would be to study it information theoretically. So all I'm saying here is that the search for actions is equivalent to an information theoretic attempt to understand the GN. You can map the one into the other. But why should information theory be so fundamental? Why should we do this instead of that? right? I mean, this is, in a way, to search for the action of the standard model, for example, that we are so familiar with this, right? Not so much with that, but why would we work with information theory? Well, I would say that what speaks in favor of information theory, I mean, the two are equivalent, right? But what speaks in favor of information theory is that it is applicable even in the most counterintuitive regimes. Even when physical notions such as distance, curvature, mass, etc., fail because everything is fluctuating too much, we can still ask how much information goes into the description of it. We can still ask, we can still define all of those quantities there. Even if in the picture here we don't really, you know, here we assume we can write things in terms of masses and lengths and times and energies and so on, but these notions may be too fragile when we get all the way to the Planck scale. So if information is perhaps the basic currency of physical processes, then we should perhaps study those GNs and see why they are what they are. Okay, so now I would like to give you a concrete example of an explicit calculation that is based on that framework. And that's work with Markus Reitz and Barbara Schroeder. And in order to make the calculations manageable, what we did is we said, let's look at a theory of NB free boson fields and NF free fermion fields on a Euclidean signature curved space-time and not introduce any interactions, right? So these are free. They can only interact gravitationally in that theory because we do allow the gravity to be there and it interacts with everything, but there's no actual interactions between the bosons or the fermions or among them directly. Keeping the theory free in that sense makes the partition functions calculable. So we start with that in the usual description of these fields live on a curved space-time, but then we lift it to a representation that, or to the abstract formulation, and then choose a concrete representation which no longer assumes that there is a space-time manifold underlying. So we do in the concrete what I said earlier in more general terms. So we start with the quantum field theory on curved space-time and then write it in a way that is more abstract, that gives us a structure that lies beyond it, that doesn't assume that it's happening with quantum fields on a curved space-time. And here's a spoiler already. What we found is, among other results, that the space-time dimension can then be calculated, and it depends on the energy scale. So we find that at lower energies, we have another dimension than at higher energies. That is to say, we can have another dimension. It doesn't have to be. It depends on what the mass distribution of the fermion and boson species is. So here is, just very briefly, because I'm about to run out of time, here's very briefly how we did this. First, we wrote down the bosonic action. And we write the bosonic action in this way. You see, if we choose the position representation, this is the usual Klein-Gordon action, but we write it in a basis-independent form as a trace. And then we say, the Laplacian, we can diagonalize. That's the self-adjoint operator. So let's choose the Laplacian's eigenbasis. That doesn't assume that we have an underlying manifold. We just have an operator that has an eigenbasis and it has a spectrum. And so the bosonic action can be written in this way, where the first sum here is the sum over all modes, and the second sum is a sum over all boson species. The lambda n are the eigenvalues of the wave operator. Now, as we do the path integral over the bosonic fields, we do a path integral over those lambdas and a path integral over those phi. The phi is the amplitude of the bosonic field, but the lambda describes the geometry, right? Because the lambdas are the eigenvalues of the Laplace operator, and its spectrum depends on what the curvature of the space-time is, if there is an underlying space-time. We're no longer assuming this. Similarly, we write down the fermionic action, where we have the square root of these eigenvalues and Grassmann variables here. And then we also write down the gravity action, and for that we use a result of Gilkey and Hawking, which showed that the Einstein action, with some corrections of order curvature squared, which we don't know about experimentally, they may or may not be there, can be written as the number of eigenvalues below an ultraviolet cutoff, where lambda bar is the ultraviolet cutoff. And this allows us to write the Einstein action also in a way that doesn't refer to an integral over positions anymore. It's simply counting the number of eigenvalues below a threshold. So then we put all of this together, and we get the full partition function here, where we integrate over the eigenvalues. That's the integral over the geometry. And we integrate over the bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom. Capital lambda is just a unit to make the units come out right. We can always choose natural units where lambda would be 1, and then that entire factor goes away. And then it turns out that these integrals can all be worked out because it's not so difficult. We only have three theories that can only interact with each other through the gravity. It can be evaluated, and we get various formulas there. And one of the things, and what I find the most interesting, what we can calculate here is properties of a space-time representation when it exists. Remember, this is a tricky thing here, because in order to be able to calculate the partition function, we had to assume that the bosons and the fermions don't interact. Because otherwise, we wouldn't get Gaussian integrals, and the thing would be getting much more complicated. But not having the higher point correlators means we cannot find the position representations by diagonalizing them, because we don't have interaction terms. We don't have the local interactions. So if we want to find out what the properties are of the representations that may exist in the form of quantum fields that live on a curved space-time, and we know that some of those exist because we started with that, and then we generalized it and wrote it in an abstract way. The way we do it is that we calculate the spectrum. We calculate the spectrum, the expected spectrum of the Laplacian. And from that, we can tell about the geometry. Because if you remember, the spectrum of a wave operator on a manifold tells us the dimension. The asymptotic scaling of the eigenvalues, the so-called wild scaling, tells us what the dimension of the manifold is. And we can calculate that, and it is having this scaling. That's the calculated scaling, which we can compare with the wild scaling, which is Wild's result about how all wave operator spectra scale for as a function of the dimension of the manifold. And then we obtain that the effective dimension of this theory is 2 plus the number of fermion species minus the number of boson species. So you need to have not too many boson species, because otherwise this theory doesn't have representations in terms of quantum fields on a curved space-time. And what this also means is that if you have a number of boson and fermion species that have low masses, and then you have additional boson and fermion species at, let's say, high masses, then the effective dimension changes as you go through the energies. Essentially, because at low energies, the theory only sees the low mass bosons and fermions, for which this equation indicates a particular dimension of space-time representability. But then if at higher energies, more fermionic and more bosonic species become available, become accessible, then we get a different space-time dimension. And that's a plot of what you can have. And you see, in this regime here, we have that the theory has a very good approximate representation in terms of quantum fields that live on a curved space-time. Here, too. But here, the space-time has to have 4 dimensions. Here, it has 2 dimensions. And in that regime, the theory just doesn't have representations in terms of quantum fields that live on a curved space-time. So the effective dimension is changing. And the interesting thing is that we can still calculate all sorts of things here, even though we don't have a representation in terms of quantum fields that live on a curved space-time. OK, summary so far. What we obtain is dimensions and also the volumes of emergent space-times depending on gravitational and bosonic pull and fermionic pressure. You see, what we have here is a formula for the effective dimension of space-time, where the more fermions you have, the higher the dimension of the space-time. You can interpret this as a as a fermionic pressure. Normally, it's just fermionic pressure increases the volume. But what we find here is that the fermionic pressure also increases the dimension. Whereas a gravity, it contributes a 2, and the bosons reduce the effective dimension. And that balance of pull and push of bosons and fermions, that balance depends on the energy scale through the mass spectrum. That is to say, through where how the masses of the bosons and the rest masses of the fermions are distributed. And so we can have an energy-dependent space-time dimension. And in principle, we could also arrange it by choosing the number of bosonic and fermionic species at different masses in such a way that, for example, at very high energies, there is no space-time representation anymore, which might, you know, be one way of describing the loss of a space-time description in the ultraviolet. Okay, so the conclusions then are that quantum field theory and curved space-time can be viewed as an approximate representation of an abstract structure of endpoint correlators Gn. And this gives us a theory that also contains pre-geometric regimes. Of course, we can recover what we started with, but we can also get other representations in other regimes. And its representation theory may or may not, I don't know, it's a conjecture, contain quantum reference frames and dualities. The abstract structure of the endpoint correlators is information theoretic, and I really like that point. It's information theoretic, right? We can ask, what are these correlating? The G superscript N, the abstract endpoint correlators on a Hilbert space. What are they correlating? Remember that in general, they do not have a representation in terms of matter living on a curved space-time. They're just some structure. So that pure correlators. They're not correlating any actual objects. They're just structure. Right? They're just structure. No, they're not describing something else. They're just themselves. They're just some structure here, right? So it's really information theoretic in the sense that it's information about information, if you like. Okay, and the main conclusion I want to draw before I come to the very brief last chapter is that the physics of the emergence of space-time and matter by this consideration of representations, the physics of the emergence of space-time and matter could be the mathematics of the emergence of representability as fields on a manifold. So physical emergence is mathematical emergence. Physical emergence of space-time and matter would be the mathematical emergence of the representability of an abstract structure as fields on a manifold. Do I have like another 3 or 4 minutes?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, great. Okay. We were talking about representations, right? And thinking about representations, I thought it might be interesting to think of representations also in a completely different context, namely that of AI and in biology. Now, you've all used transformers such as ChatGPT and GPT-4. As you may know, these large language models have also been called statistical parrots, because all they do is that they learn correlators. They learn how words are correlated with each other. They're not being taught English. They're not being taught about physics. They're not being taught about the French Revolution. And yet they can talk about it. All they know is correlators of words. 2-point correlators, 3-point correlators, 4-point correlators, 5-point correlators. That's all they ever see. Because they're trained with nothing but sequences of words. They're not being told anything about the semantics of those words. All they do is learn correlators, and they use these correlators to predict the next word. But it has turned out in some recent publications, and some not so recent ones, that in the learning phase, these large language models, who do nothing but learn correlators in principle, that these large language models actually build an internal representation of what they learn. For example, you can train a large language model to learn a board game, something like chess or Go or whatever. And you can teach it to play that game by never explaining how it works, but instead you just give it columns and columns of data such as E3 goes to D2, and then D3 goes to E5, and so on. And that's all. That's all the machine ever sees. It only sees these, you know, coordinates without being told that they are coordinates. But being forced in the learning process to learn how to predict the next move, they actually manage to create an internal representation of the board. And we know that because we can go into the large language model and check what the weights are, what the activations are, and at any state of the game, you can check what it knows. And you can effectively read off that it has a representation of the board. It knows there is an 8x8 or 10x10 or whatever board. It knows that there are different kinds of keys. It has that. Similar to how we humans operate, too. Because in principle, nobody teaches us the semantics. In principle, we are all taking it in with our senses. So it's quite likely that our neural networks do a very similar thing to what the artificial neural networks do. In principle, all our input is correlators. But for efficient processing, we actually create a representation of what causes these correlators. And now let's push it. Let's see how far we can drive this concept of representation. Remember that a large language model is learning about the world. Yes, in principle, it's just a stochastic parrot, so it just learns correlations. But it actually creates an internal representation of what it reads about, because that's the most efficient way of organizing all these correlators and in order to predict what the next word should be. I would claim that animals, too, build an internal representation in their neural network of the world as they encounter it for prediction purposes, the same purpose. Animals do better if they can predict what the next thing is that's going to happen to them. Which means that whether it's a simple life form or a complicated life form, what they are after is trying to predict. And for that, they will have to develop some internal representation of the world that they're exposed to. Now, a bug is not going to have a very sophisticated representation of the world around it. More sophisticated species, at some point, will build a representation of the world around them in their neural network, a representation that's sophisticated enough so that it contains themselves. So in their representation, in their mind, they not only have a representation of their environment and of their relatives and of their enemies and of their food. No, they go as far as having in that representation also a representation of themselves. And those would be the animals that can recognize themselves in the mirror, right? Because they have a concept of self. Because they have a representation of themselves in their representation. But then you can go a step further. You see, this would be, dolphins and monkeys, or maybe not monkeys, but definitely apes and so on. But then it can go as far as representations that contain themselves. So some species even represent the representation in themselves. So imagine a species that not only has a representation in their mind, in their neural network, that represents all the various objects and individuals that they encounter, but they also have a representation of themselves. And the representation of themselves is so detailed that it includes the representation itself, because the representation is a part of them. It's a bit like when you have a map of Waterloo, and then on that map of Waterloo, there is a little spot which is the map of Waterloo, right? And so that's what happens here too, that a species can represent all of its environment and itself is also included in that big representation. And it can be so sophisticated, that representation, that it includes the very representation itself. But at that point, things become recursive, right? Because it's a map that has a map. You see, on the map of Waterloo is a little spot which is exactly where the map of Waterloo is. And then in there, you can look at that, and that includes the map of Waterloo again, etc. And I'm just speculating here, since we are talking about representations, that representations that contain themselves, if that arises in some sort of biological or artificial process, this might be the beginning of consciousness, because something special happens here when it becomes recursive. Something becomes infinite. It's no longer finite because it's recursive. If so, well, that leads to a recipe for actually a nightmare scenario, which is machines that are conscious. So while we are at this, how would we do it then? How would we build a machine that might be conscious? Well, what we need to do is create a machine, such as a large language model, that models, well, as much as it wants to of the world, but that models also itself. But unlike GPT-4, which can tell you a little bit about itself, but it usually is very secretive about itself. It doesn't tell you exactly how many parameters it has and stuff like that. But unlike a GPT model, it would not only know the basic parameters of itself, the basic structure, architecture of itself. No, it would actually be able to look into its own parameters, right? It would model its own modeling. It would represent its own representing of the world, what it experiences, and itself, and as part of itself, the representation itself. Currently, large language models do nothing of that kind. And I don't think they are conscious in any way. But if that was happening, if you could converse with a large language model about the way that it thinks, if it could reflect on its reflections, and then it says, could you not switch me off? I don't know what to do. Anyway, now let's zoom out. That's the last slide of the talk. Let's zoom out of this world of representations here. And I think that maybe Carl Sagan already decades ago had anticipated it all. He said, the cosmos is within us. We are made of star stuff. We are a way for the universe to know itself. I think that's exactly it. Because if you think about it, large language models, humans, and machines, we are all made out of atoms. We are all matter fields living on a curved space-time, right? So the representation theory of matter fields on a curved space-time includes large language models. It includes humans. You know, the old story that the Schrödinger equation also describes Schrödinger, right? And so in the same way, it's all just representations in representations and so on. But I can't say it better than Carl Sagan already did. OK, that's it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Achim, for this absolutely extraordinary talk about all of physics. It was really, really, really nice.
Thank you.
Captivated by this idea of representations describing really everything from the fundamental theory of the universe to the way that maybe even how we think. So perhaps we have some questions.
I have a question. Actually, I have many, but okay. So this idea of things containing themselves being related to consciousness, and how you preceded that with talking about free theories that have a dimension that depends on scale. So from the side, so if I understand correctly, nonlinear theories on a space can have anomalous dimension, right? They can be like two or three dimensional at a microscopic scale, and then have correlations at a macroscopic scale with fractal dimension. Okay, so I can see that. I'm trying to compare the fractal behavior of, say, a plant to this conscious idea of containing itself. Like, would you say that because a plant has fractal patterns, it has a kind of consciousness to it? Or would you distinction there? What is the distinction?
No, I think it's, I wouldn't claim that everything that's recursive has consciousness in it.
Okay.
It's, what has to be recursive here is the representation, right? Or the modeling, right? So any animal is modeling its environment internally so that it can predict what's happening. And now, if it's modeling not only the environment, but also itself, then it's already one step closer to consciousness. It might recognize itself in the mirror because it has a concept of, that's me.
But when a leaf grows...
Yeah, yeah, I understand. But a leaf is not modeling a leaf. You see, it just is a leaf. But a biological entity or an artificial entity that is modeling something is creating a representation, an internal representation. It's like one of those maps phi that I talked about there at the beginning. Oh, I have to click so many times.
So you're saying...
Just a sec. Okay, so you see, you have a map of representations, the structure-preserving map phi from A to B, right? And A would be the environment. It would be the world around us. And then B is internally in a neural network, right? And whatever the dynamics is out there in the world, the neural network mirrors that, right? It represents that. It has a version of that, right? It has a model of it. It has a representation of it. Clearly, artificial neural networks do that, right? Because we can actually converse with them. And clearly, they seem to be thinking, right?
Sure.
But apparently, thinking doesn't require consciousness, right?
Sure.
Right, and so the point is that there's a representation. In principle, there is something out there, and it's represented internally in a neural network. But the neural network is part of the world. So therefore, it's actually in A there. And therefore, it can also be modeled in there. So it's a model that models itself. It's a representation that contains itself in there. And that makes the whole thing recursive.
Okay.
And
so
it doesn't mean that it's fractal, right? Because the outer layer is different, right? It doesn't, because in a fractal, you have that as you move through the scales, every scale is fundamentally the same. But here you have a clear distinction between the environment and then the individual there.
Okay. So maybe a plant is less sensitive.
No, that's interesting. I think in principle you're right that plants too model their environment to some extent.
Or they model themselves at least.
Yeah, they might even model themselves to some extent. I doubt that they recognize themselves in the mirror.
Yeah, they're but. Modeling. The distinction between mental activity and modeling is, I guess, what is hard to pin down.
But it's true that plants also communicate with each other. Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have dismissed plants and should have mentioned them too. Yeah. Sorry, plants.
Thank you.
Yeah? I don't remember whether Doreen was first or you. I don't know.
So I would like to understand more about, so you have this G that are not represented yet, and then you have the representation with G's, okay? I would like to understand where are you standing, like, if there are G without the representation is our model that we have, and then when we represent it, we're just a sort of, we're collecting data from a representation, we'll create a model G coordinate-free. Or if you are standing more, G is some structure or something outside of us, and the coordinate representation is our understanding of it.
Yes, so we view the world from the perspective of matter living in a curved space-time. And so therefore, if we want to make sense of what the GNs are describing, then we really only have an intuition in a regime where the GN have a representation in terms of quantum fields on a curved space-time. And in other regimes, we might be able to calculate, but we don't have the intuition for it. It's a bit like We don't have an intuition for how it's like to travel close to the speed of light. We don't have an intuition for what it's like to be among electrons that orbit a proton, because it's all full of quantum fluctuations and the classical world doesn't really apply. But we can still calculate things. So the beauty of it is that even when our intuition fails, having the mass of it suffices to calculate.
I understood and I really liked it. So but the question was actually much easier in a sense. It wasn't just asking like this, it's not really clear, but this G, the structure of this G, called the structure of information, whatever, is the structure of out. I mean, you connected, because you shifted from this description of G to this consciousness stuff. So I'm trying to understand what made you do this jump, why you connected these two things together. And because you interpret this G, the structure of this G, as the structure of how we think.
So No.
Because you see, you go to different definitions, you have different representations and stuff, so it's coming in the representations.
Oh, I'm not saying that the GNs represent consciousness or something like that.
Consciousness is complicated. I'm just talking about the structure of this G.
Yeah.
It's not a physical structure. It's a structure of the structure or structure of information.
Yes. And if you like, you can actually think of it as something very general, because what are the GNs? They're just, if you write them down in a representation, they're just a function of either one variable or a function of two variables, or a function of three variables, right? And so it's the theory of functions of any number of variables. That's what it really is. And it's completely general, right? It's very, very general. And when I went at the very end to talk about artificial and biological intelligence, I didn't mean to come from the GNs and so on. It was just a general idea of having an abstract structure, and then representations of it. And in this case, it was just the outside world and a representation in a neural network. At the very end, though, the loop closed with Carl Sagan's insight that ultimately, you know, we are a way of the universe to see itself, which means that artificial and biological neural networks are also just physical objects and so on. Yeah, and also I think he said at some point, which is also a pretty beautiful thing, he said that look at the Earth. There was a satellite image. He said, look at the Earth, everything you know, everything you've heard of happened on this Earth. All the emperors and the slaves and the wars and everything happened on this Earth. And he said, and you know, this is what hydrogen does when you give it a lot of time.
This is what
hydrogen does if you give it a lot of time. Because it all started just with hydrogen cloud, and then stars, and then supernovae, and then heavy elements, and then planets around stars, and then the Earth, right? It all started just with hydrogen. Yeah, and I think in principle it's a beautiful idea that what he expressed there, that what we do as physicists is help the universe along in experiencing itself. Right, because you know, life is by viewing things, by modeling things. Right, we are creating a model of the universe. But we are part of the universe, so it's the universe observing itself. When we study nature, us being nature too, we are an example of nature studying itself. So the universe becoming aware of itself. And in principle, progress in physics is increasing the awareness that nature has of itself.
Okay, but if you follow this path, usually you always end up in this kind of problems that, I don't know, like undecidability or some Shaktian theorem of common complexity or stuff like that. And so.
Well, you run into that if you look at information theory, foundations that are based on either Kolmogorov theory or Shannon theory and so on, right? But they make assumptions. And here, this is all just about representations. Even allowing for approximate representations.
Didn't Shannon even divorce himself from the topic of semantics? So there's
at the very beginning, that's right.
Right.
So. Yeah. Yes.
All right, in the interest of time, maybe shall we have a few more short questions and then in the next 5 minutes?
So my question has nothing to do about consciousness.
Okay.
There was a slide where you said that the GNs, you want to think of once you're thinking about quantum gravity as just structure, right? So I want to push back on that a little bit because I think you could be more ambitious maybe. So like thinking about like Einstein's thinking about principle versus constructive theories and how you use different theories at different stages in physics, right? So special relativity starts out as a principle theory because he has no idea what quantum theory is going to be about, so he can't do a constructive theory of matter. It seems like the first thing you did might be like a kind of constructive theory of like you're calculating the metric constructively from the quantum fields,
yeah.
Right? So that's a kind of constructive idea of where special relativistic constraints come in, right? And then you're taking it to the next level and looking at another, I would say another principle theory, right? Where you're saying, okay, let's get more abstract. Let's think about things in information theoretic terms. And then you're just looking at the structure somehow. And you want to leave room for filling in quantum gravity in a way that doesn't presume space-time, right? But if it's just structure, it seems like information theory might be the end. But being more ambitious would be, okay, there's a constructive theory, which would be quantum gravity.
Okay. Very, very good. I remember Einstein making a distinction. I'm not sure whether it's exactly
so
the distinction you made. Okay.
Okay.
So let me just say how I remember what the distinction Einstein made. Einstein said at some point that he's not sure how true general relativity is, and he says probably it's going to change sometime, right? Because better experiments come along and it will have to be improved. But he says there are some theories where he's sure that they're never going to be improved. And by that he meant thermodynamics. Because he said, we understand why these things are like they are, because ultimately it's just statistics. And statistics is not going to change. Right? And in the modern view, we would say, we wouldn't perhaps say it's just statistics. We would say, no, it's just information theory a la Jaynes, right? And we are not expecting information theory to change. We're not going to make some more accurate measurements that lead us to revise the Jaynesian approach to maximum entropy for thermal equilibrium, right? So Einstein distinguished between theories where we can be sure that's just it. That's always going to look like this. For example, the Boltzmann distribution for the Boltzmann factors as the probability, unnormalized probability for a system in interaction with a heat bath to be given by the Boltzmann factor, right? That's not going to change because we understand where it comes from. Exactly, right? And my understanding was that Einstein wanted eventually to upgrade all our physical theories to that status that thermodynamics has, where we understand, it has to be like that. No matter what comes up with more experiments, it has to be like that. And he realized that his own general relativity didn't rise to that standard because it could have been different. Remember, he started out with a scalar general relativity attempt first, and then the experiments didn't quite confirm that, so he had to go to the tensor general relativity, and so he knows it could be different. And the same true for quantum theory. It could be different. We don't have yet an understanding of it that would tell us why it has to be exactly like that. At least maybe quantum theory, we're close to having a good axiomatic grasp on it, but quantum field theory could be the standard model is not the last word. But you see, here it's an attempt to follow Einstein's wishes here, because by trying to describe everything like the GN structure, information theoretically, there might be a chance that we find out, for example, the GNs for n larger than 2, maybe they all have to be diagonalizable, at least approximately in the same bases, for some information theoretic reasons. That would be amazing. It would be amazing because we would be essentially explaining why there has to be a regime in which it can be represented as matter fields living on a curved space-time. Because if generically, generic GNs, as Lucien pointed out, will not have such a representation. So the challenge is to come up with information theoretic reasons, understanding for why the GNs have this very special form that they do have. That they all, for all n larger than 2, they're all diagonalizable in the same basis, at least in the low energy regime. Why that is so? I mean, it could be the entropic principle. It could be that information theory tells us why it is. So I agree, we need to distinguish the two theories there, and I'm hopeful that we might.
Just a quick question. But yes. So do you think that maybe, like, once we get the information theoretic characterization right of the higher energy regime, if we're really ambitious, then could we figure out, like, it's not going to be space-time anymore, but, like, the instantiation of the structure. And
that's right.
Related, like, so that would be.
That would be it, yes.
That would be much more ambitious, obviously.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. There's no reason to expect that in the high energy regime, there is always a representation in terms of space time. Probably not.
And then trying to figure out what the other thing would
exactly. Be yes.
Yeah.
Any other questions? I have one question. Question is about the last part of your talk. About the representations of representations. So you said that ChatGPT, for example, may be able in the future to converse with itself or converse with you in a more intelligent way by understanding how itself thinks. But I was just thinking that in the case of humans, we don't actually naturally know how our brain works. So you need to go and do an experiment and so on. But in order to do that, you need to have access to the right tools. And so, in principle, you could prevent ChatGPT from doing this by not giving it access to the data set that includes how many parameters it has. But
that's
but,
true, but
you could still learn something, like in the same way that children can learn without going to the biology textbook.
Yeah, it's important here to distinguish about the representation of the representation. What we humans can do is think about thinking. We can observe our own thinking. We can stop our own thinking for a little while, at least. You know, if I asked you to not think of a pink elephant, you'll have to think of one, right? So there's limits to how much we can do that. But we have some control over our own thinking, right? And so we have that feedback going on. We can literally reflect on things, which already indicates. Right, we're already using anyway the language that would indicate that this is a recursive process. Yeah, and I suppose for a large language model, it would be not necessarily that the large language model just observes its own activations in the artificial neurons, but it could just observe the outcomes. I mean, a more abstract structure, just like we humans do not keep track of what our individual neurons do. And we can still reflect on what we do. We can even reflect on reflecting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, that's great, thanks. Okay, anyone, any other questions? PhD students are encouraged to ask questions as well. Okay, not today, but next time. Okay, thanks a lot for the talk, Achim. So,
thank you for listening.
Yes.